We now have evidence of hundreds of planets orbiting other stars, and that's just in our little corner of the Milky Way. But are any of these planets Earth-like? Could they be habitable? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is astrophysicist Steve Kowaler of Iowa State University. He's been working with NASA's Kepler mission. The Kepler spacecraft was launched back in 2009, and it's the first attempt to look for Earth-like planets in our part of the Milky Way. Kowaler will tell us how, in 4 short years, Kepler has increased our understanding of planetary systems and stars dramatically. A journey into deep space after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. For centuries, we humans have wondered if there are other worlds like our Earth. And recently, that quest has been revived by the intense excitement surrounding the discovery that there are, in fact, hundreds of planets orbiting other stars in our galaxy. Clear evidence for substantial numbers of different types of planets outside our solar system. But are any of them anything like our Earth? Could any of them be habitable? That's what NASA's Kepler mission set out to do when it was launched back in 2009. It's the first attempt to look for Earth-like planets in our part of the Milky Way. Joining us now to give us an update on the Kepler mission's latest findings, a man who we last talked to right before Kepler was launched in 2009, Steve Kowaler, an Iowa State University professor of physics and astronomy who is affiliated with NASA's Kepler mission. Steve, great to have you back on our program.
Well, thanks, Ben. It's great to be here.
So, just as a bit of an explanation, the Kepler mission, in the time it's been out there, designates the other planetary systems it finds with numbers. And these are other planetary systems like our solar system. And today we'll be primarily talking about the neat things to do with Kepler-37 and Kepler-36. Because those have been the most recent announcements, the most recent publications from the Kepler mission. Could we start with Kepler-37 and have you tell us about it?
Well, sure. When we talk about Kepler-37, we're actually talking about the star that hosts the planets. Because many stars we're finding have multiple planet systems, just like our own solar system, we label the planets with letters. So Kepler-37b would be the innermost planet in the Kepler-37 system. Kepler-37a, if there was an A, would be the star itself. With Kepler-37, there's Kepler-37 B, C, and D. It's a three-planet system. The remarkable thing about this system, well, a couple of remarkable things about it. First is it's a three-planet system, and all the planets are the size of the Earth and smaller. So three small planets around a star. The second amazing thing is the innermost planet, Kepler-37 B, has a size that's not much bigger than the Earth's moon. So it's the smallest planet found around another star.
Okay. Tell us, how far away is Kepler-37, this star?
Most of the Kepler planet systems are within about 300 light years of the Earth. This system is probably significantly closer, maybe 100 light years.
100 light years, so yeah. It only takes 100 years for light to travel from that star to reach our eyes here on Earth. And that actually is a fairly close distance, relatively speaking.
Yeah, as far as our galaxy goes, it's the just around the corner, like between Iowa City and Ames.
Right.
The whole galaxy is about 100,000 light years across, so this is just a tiny fraction of that, less than 1%.
Can we see Kepler-37 with the naked eye?
No. It's a fairly faint star. If you have a really good pair of binoculars and know precisely where to look, you could spot it. But to see it and see it clearly requires a modest-sized telescope, something that you might find in an amateur astronomer's backyard.
Steve, you brought with you some sounds that can demonstrate something about the Kepler mission. What are they?
Well, one of the reasons why Kepler had astroseismologists on board is they need the most accurate measurement of the sizes of the stars, because without the size of the star, you don't know the size of the planet that's blocking the light. And the way we do that within astroseismology is we listen to sound waves. The sound waves cause vibrations in the star, which change the light output very slightly. So by measuring the light output, we're actually measuring the frequency of sound waves that the stars produce. Mm. A big star will produce low frequency, sort of like a cello or a viola. The smaller stars, the more compact stars, produce higher frequency sound. And so by measuring those oscillations, we can get a good handle on the size of the star to a very high precision, better than a percent.
Okay, so you've got two samples here. What are you going to play?
Yeah, well, first I'll play a sound that a star like the Sun makes. And the sound it's a little disingenuous. What we've done is we've taken the data, the light curve data, from the stars and sped it up by a factor of 86,400. What that means is that each second of the sound corresponds to 24 hours of star vibration. So let's do the Sun first, or a star like the Sun. Okay. Now we'll do a star a little bit bigger, a little bit fluffier, a little bit lower frequency. And so those two stars differ in radius by 20%. And you can imagine using more sensitive measures getting to within just a few percent.
That's fascinating. Thank you, Steve.
Sure.
So you said what is remarkable here is the size of the planets, these three planets that were discovered. Why is that remarkable? What is significant here for you as an astrophysicist?
Well, there are two things. One is just it appeals to the inner geek in me, because these planets are all as small as or smaller than we ever expected to be able to use Kepler to find. Because they're so tiny, they produce a very tiny signal blocking the light from Kepler-37, the host star. Kepler was designed to be able to find these very tiny dips, but we never expected to be able to find as tiny a dip as a star, as a planet the size of Mercury or the Moon would produce. So the technical achievement of finding not one but three tiny planets around this star is the thing that's almost spine-chilling, in the sense that, wow, we are doing way better than we thought we could.
So we're talking about a pinprick of light we cannot see with the naked eye from Earth that is detected, and you are measuring the difference in the amount of light coming from that less than a pinprick of light to determine planets moving in front of it?
Exactly. We're looking at stellar eclipses in some sense. The light from the star is fairly faint, but with a decent-sized telescope, you can measure the rate at which light is coming from it extremely precisely. When a planet in that system passes between us and the star, if the alignment is just right, the light from that star will drop by a few parts per million. Okay, so in this particular case, it was about 70 parts per million that the light from the star was dimmed by the planet going around it.
Mm-hmm.
To measure that light at that level of precision is the real miracle of Kepler. Just to give you a sense, if you've got fluorescent lights in the studio there, they're flickering. You're lucky you don't notice it, but they're flickering at the few percent level. That's a tiny flicker compared to what our eyes can perceive. But with Kepler and instruments like it, we can measure flickers that are hundreds of thousands of times less than that.
Mm-hmm. Was it anticipated that it would be this exacting?
Well, we knew we would get to 100 parts per million, 80 parts per million, around fairly bright stars. But we're finding that we're reaching that level and better around fainter stars. So it's doing a lot better than we had anticipated.
So one, the technical achievement here, what else is significant in regards to Kepler-37?
Well, we're now exploring planetary systems where planets are significantly smaller than the Earth. Kepler was designed not so much to find the twin of the Earth, but was designed to characterize planetary systems in the galaxy as a whole. That is, the power of Kepler was supposed to be the statistical nature of the results. What fraction of stars have planets around them? What fraction of those planets are Earth-like? And so the goal was to find lots of them by looking at a huge number of stars. Up until Kepler-37, we really hadn't seen any data that could tell us about the distribution of low-mass planets, planets smaller than the Earth, nor did we expect to. But now that we've demonstrated that Kepler can find tiny planets, we can now expand our survey of planetary systems in the solar system down to planets like the smallest planets on our own, which means we can do a much more complete job of figuring out how common are solar systems like ours.
Mm-hmm. In addition to size, does Kepler tell anything about these planets, what they're made of, for instance?
Another interesting point about Kepler that sometimes is kind of lost in all the planetary discoveries is Kepler does not look at the planets. It only looks at the stars. And so any information we get about the planet comes simply from their shadows in the starlight. From those shadows, though, we can measure the size of the planet, the radius, the diameter, the the surface area, if you will, of the planets. And from that, and an indication of the mass of the planet, we get a very powerful diagnostic, which is the density of the planet. In some cases, we find a planet, let's say the mass of Jupiter, that's the size of Jupiter. So we know that its composition can't be that different than Jupiter, because its density, if it was rock, would be much higher. It would be much smaller for that mass. In addition to their densities, we can also use the data to see how reflective the planets are. Kepler is so sensitive that he can actually see the planet going from new planet to full planet in phase, just like our moon goes from new moon to full moon. And you can see the extra light from the planet with the starlight reflecting off of it, which gives you a measure of how reflective the planet is. And knowing the size and knowing how reflective it is, we can tell whether there are clouds on the surface, for example, or whether it's a dark body like the moon.
Mm-hmm. We used to think when we talk about the solar system that, well, solar systems must be like ours, or we assume that the architecture of a solar system, you have these smaller planets inside and these larger planets. Talk a little bit about how these other planetary systems that have been discovered in the last few years by Kepler have a different variation in the way they're set up.
Well, our understanding of what a typical planetary system looks like has gone through a 360-degree rotation, if you will, over the last 4 years. Before Kepler went up, most of the planetary systems we found had a Jupiter mass planet, a big, fluffy, massive planet, very close to the star, within an orbit equivalent to the Earth's orbit. The reason we were finding all of those is those are the easiest ones to find using techniques different than what Kepler uses. So we would find lots and lots of so-called hot Jupiters and think to ourselves, maybe hot Jupiters are the normal, and our solar system is really weird. But Kepler changed all that.
Mm. So is that in any way comforting?
Very comforting.
How so?
Well, I don't know how you felt as a kid, but as a kid growing up, I loved watching science fiction. Lost in Space, the original, was my favorite TV show. And I fell in love with the idea of living in a galaxy with lots and lots of alien civilizations, hopefully friendly. But as I grew up and became an astronomer and saw how difficult it was to find any planetary systems, I began to sort of wonder if indeed we are the lone duck in the solar in the galaxy. And so Kepler finding all of these solar systems that don't have a killer planet really close to the star or anything like that is comforting, because it makes me feel like my childhood wishes are coming true, and that indeed there are lots of solar systems in our galaxy that aren't all that different from ours. That's been the main sort of exciting result from Kepler. Again, from a statistical standpoint, we're finding lots of planetary systems with Earth mass planets a little bit bigger than the Earth, in reasonable orbits around their stars that might allow life to develop. And we're just looking at a tiny slice of the galaxy and finding hundreds of systems like this. So it really is a comforting turnaround from the time before Kepler, where we thought that most planetary systems had a big planet nearby, to finding lots of solar systems where smaller rocky planets that might have breathable atmospheres were orbiting the stars at just the right distance.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and my guest this hour, Steve Kowaler. He's an Iowa State University professor of physics and astronomy, affiliated, working with NASA's Kepler mission, and that's a spacecraft that was launched in 2009, sent out into space as the first attempt to look for Earth-like planets in our part of the Milky Way, our little corner, as I think Steve mentioned before, which turns out to be incredibly vast, even though it's relatively close to us. We were talking about the planetary system, the star, more correctly, as you pointed out, Kepler-37. Another recent announcement, publication by the Kepler mission, has concerned another planetary system, Kepler-36. Steve, tell us about that.
Well, Kepler-36 is another fun system. Again, Kepler's been finding systems that look sort of like our solar system, but with very interesting wrinkles. And Kepler-36 is one of those. That has two planets, at least, associated with it, two interesting planets. They orbit their star in orbits that are almost the same. That is, one planet is slightly interior to the star compared to the other. They get very close together as a result. Every few orbits, every six orbits, the two planets come about to within about a million miles of one another.
So are they going the same direction? Is it like
yes.
you're passing someone on the interstate maybe?
Exactly.
Rather than a two-lane highway coming against them, right?
That's right, yes. They are going in the same direction. That's another result from Kepler is that almost all of the systems we find, the planets are all orbiting in the same direction. So this isn't a counterexample, luckily, because the dynamics would be really exciting then. But a million miles apart is only about four times the distance between the Earth and the Moon. So if you can imagine in our solar system having a planet like Neptune in an orbit similar in scale to our Earth, every 7 years you would see Neptune looming in the sky, covering about 30 degrees of the sky.
So it would be this huge mountainous thing in the sky.
Exactly, exactly. It'd be very exciting.
Wow.
I think that astronomy would have developed a whole lot faster on the Earth had that happened because people might recognize the perils involved.
Mm-hmm. Having another planet, these two planets close together, passing so close, does that provide a peril for that planetary system, for these planets?
We don't think so. You can actually look, now that we know a lot about the planetary system, because each planet does tug on the other, and that allows us to measure the mass of each planet very precisely. That combined with what we know about the star allows us to project into the distant future how stable these orbits are. And it looks like they'll never get any closer. The system has been doing this for quite a while. How it got this way is another matter entirely. But the fact that it's there now suggests that it will be stable for a very, very long time, mm-hmm. hundreds of millions of years.
So you mentioned that in the last 4 years of the Kepler mission, the evolution of thinking about solar systems, actually planetary systems, and how they're formed has really gone through drastic change. So what is our thinking now about how planetary systems like our solar system are formed and the variations you can have?
Well, the basic idea goes back actually several centuries, the idea that our solar system formed as a byproduct of the formation of our sun, the collapse of a nebula. As that nebula collapsed, it started spinning faster and faster, just like an ice skater spins faster and faster as he or she pulls her arms in. But that spinning flattened out the gas cloud, and in the center, that's where most of the mass was, the star forms. But in the outer regions of this gas and dust cloud is where the planets form by sort of miniature versions of the formation of the star at the center. This general idea produces a solar system like ours with rocky planets close to the star where it was hotter when the nebula was forming, so hot that all of the gases were driven off. And in the outer part of that disk where it's cool enough that liquid water would freeze, you could make bigger planets because you're making them out of hydrogen and oxygen, much more abundant elements than iron, which was left after the star heated up the center of the nebula. And so this general picture of a collapse of a nebula into a disk with a star in the middle, rocky planets on the inside, and gassy, icy planets on the outside explain pretty well how our solar system formed. All the planets are sort of orbiting in the same plane and in the same direction with the gas giants on the outside and Earth-like planets on the inside. What shook this model up before Kepler was the discovery of these hot Jupiters, because in order to make a massive planet, a planet tens of times the mass of the Earth, you can't make it out of rock. There's just not enough rock available. You need the ices, the more common things that we find in space. And so you needed to make an icy, gaseous planet very close to the star, and that was, we thought, impossible because the star being so hot, it would have driven all of that, the gas and water vapor away.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way astronomers figured out how to make one of these hot Jupiter systems was to form the massive planet far away from the star, as in our solar system, but then to allow interactions between that planet and other planets to sort of slingshot the planet closer into the star after it already achieved that gigantic proportion. That seemed to work in the process of moving in, though, that hot, now hot Jupiter had ejected all of the lower mass planets and it was basically a solo planet around its star. That seemed fairly common, like I said, because we were finding so many of them. That was sort of an extra wrinkle, if you will, on the general scenario of how you make a solar system out of a nebula. But now we're finding again that there are lots more systems with smaller rocky planets on the inside and massive Jupiter-like planets on the outside, mm-hmm. suggesting that first model does work and that this migration scenario, the massive Jupiter moving in closer to the star, doesn't happen all that often.
Mm-hmm. And so it's just that we are better at seeing the smaller rocky planets than we were in previous years.
Exactly, exactly.
Now, so the question here is also, in finding out so much about other planetary systems, can we say at this point whether Earth is atypical or typical when a planetary system is formed?
Well, that's been the goal of the Kepler mission. How typical is the Earth? The way astronomers phrase it, the question is, what is eta Earth? Eta Earth is this variable in an equation called the Drake equation, which gives the fraction of planetary systems that have an Earth-like planet. And by Earth-like, that means roughly the size of the Earth in an orbit around its star where liquid water can exist on the surface. So not too close, not too far. And that's the question you just asked is the question that Kepler was designed to answer, and we're getting closer. I wouldn't hazard a guess at the moment more than just a ballpark guess, but what we're finding is that roughly 15 to 20% of planets probably have an Earth-like planet in their system. So again, ballpark figure, 20% maybe, of the stars that you see up in the sky that are anything like our sun have an Earth-like planet in their system.
So that's when recently astronomers at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics used the Kepler data. Are you referring to that to estimate how many Earth-sized planets there are? So when you do that calculation, how many is that? Because it's a large number, isn't it?
In terms of numbers, yeah, that's a pretty big number. If you extrapolate the Kepler sample, again, the Kepler sample is just sort of this little wedge of our galaxy, into something like the galaxy as a whole, you get a number in the, I don't know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions?
The article I read said at least 17 billion Earth-sized exoplanets in the Milky Way galaxy.
That I would say, is an upper limit. There's a separation between Earth-sized planet and Earth-like planet.
Oh.
Okay? Earth-sized planet could be anywhere in the planetary system, so 17 billion I would buy.
Okay.
In terms of having a planet roughly the size of the Earth somewhere in orbit around the sun. But if you say, is it Earth-like, that adds a whole extra dimension because now you're asking about an Earth-sized planet at the right distance from its host star so that it's not too hot and not too cold for life to develop. And that brings that 17 billion down to only 10 million or so.
And these are in our Milky Way galaxy.
Correct.
Or in our part of the Milky Way, our arm. We're on an arm of the Milky Way, aren't we?
That's right. Yeah, this would be in the Milky Way as a whole. So I'm much more excited about the Earth-like planets than the Earth-sized planets.
Okay. We want to continue our discussion in just a moment. My guest this hour is Steve Kowaler. He is an Iowa State University professor of physics and astronomy, affiliated with NASA's Kepler mission. In fact, last time we spoke, Steve, it was right before the launch I believe, the spring of 2009. You remember that?
That's correct, yeah. It was actually late winter. It was early March.
Oh, was it? Okay. Mm-hmm. Early March. It's been out there 4 years. And when we come back in just a moment, we want to talk more about this amazing spacecraft called Kepler, how it works, where it is right now in space, and talk more about the discoveries and potential discoveries by the Kepler mission when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. You know, for centuries, we're talking about this hour, the fact that humans have wondered if there are other worlds like our Earth. And that's really at the heart of our conversation today with Steve Kowaler. He is an Iowa State University professor of physics and astronomy, affiliated with NASA's Kepler mission. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it was launched in 2009. And it's a spacecraft, and it's able to peer at other stars in our galaxy, our part of the galaxy, and even detect other planets circling those stars in a way that we have never, ever been able to do. Steve Kowaler joins us from our studio in Ames to tell us a little bit about the latest discoveries of Kepler and things that we may be discovering in the near future. So we talked about, Steve, Kepler 36 and 37. These planetary systems are numbered by the Kepler mission. Actually, the stars are. How far will these numbers go? How many stars does Kepler have to look at?
Well, Kepler's mission includes 160,000 stars that it started monitoring anyway back in 2009. Of those, not all are planet candidates or other stars where we expect or even hope to find planets. But the target list is still pretty large when we're looking at planet hosts. Right now, we've got about 3,000 planetary candidates. The difference between a candidate and a system is there. We've seen this little dip that we were talking about earlier where the planet passes in front of the star, but maybe we only saw it once. And you don't know if it's a planet until you see it again the next time the planet goes around the star, and that could take years. So we've confirmed about rock-solid confirmation of about 200 planets. Less solid confirmation, that is suspected planets that we know aren't probably not a false positive, in the thousands.
Okay, so you look at a star, you look at with the instruments aboard Kepler for a certain amount of time to detect if there are planets. If it looks like there are, then you keep your attention on it. Otherwise, you move on.
Well, no, Kepler keeps looking at everything. It's a very simple spacecraft. All it does is stare. It takes the same field of view, the same stars, and observes them continuously for the entire lifetime of the mission. So if one of those stars does show a planet, of course, scientists all jump on that and start analyzing the data in detail. But even for the systems where no planet has been found yet, Kepler will continue to watch them because it could be that there's a planet with an orbital period of 3 years around that system, in which case we may or may not have seen the first transit yet. Mm-hmm. So it's remarkably simple. The telescope just points in one direction, uses one instrument, and takes repeated images of the same exact stars.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Kepler itself. Where is it right now?
It's far away. Kepler is in an orbit around the sun, just like the Earth is. It's in what we call a sun-centered, Earth-trailing orbit. So it was launched in March of 2009, sent away from the Earth, sort of trailing behind the Earth as it goes around the sun. Right now, it's been going for 4 years. It'll take about 50 years for the Earth to catch up to it again. So it's lagging behind the Earth in the Earth's orbit. And if you can imagine, it's sort of going a little bit farther away from the Earth around a circle each year. Eventually, it'll get back to the Earth about 50 years from now. So that places it today a few tens of millions of miles away.
Mm-hmm. So why is having a craft and having the instruments, which I want to ask you about in just a moment, why is it so much better to have those not on the Earth, but out at this distance?
Well, a very simple reason. Our atmosphere, which everyone loves, we all love to breathe, is an enemy to precision photometry, to measuring stars' brightnesses very precisely. And you can see this on any clear night, even in Iowa. You go outside, you look up at the stars, and you see them twinkling, right? Twinkling, they're changing their brightness, and that's caused by hot and cold air cells in the atmosphere sort of fuzzing up the star and unfuzzing it, making it appear brighter and fainter. The twinkling of stars is at a level that's millions of times larger than the kinds of dimming that we're looking for in transits. So the only way to get that level of precision is to go above the atmosphere, all the way above the atmosphere, not to a mountaintop, not an airplane, but into space. And so to do this kind of work, you simply can't do it from the ground.
Mm, okay. So tell us, what you said it's a simple, relatively simple instrumentation. What instruments are on board?
There is a camera.
That's it?
That's it.
Wow.
It's a 1 meter diameter telescope, so that's pretty big. But all it does is focus the light onto a fairly sophisticated camera, but it's just a camera. It's a 96 megapixel, very large set of CCD detectors. It's about the size of a dinner plate embedded within the telescope that mirror focuses the light on. And we take an image of the field of view, which is about the size of your fist, if you hold your fist up to the sky, which is enormous for a telescope. It takes an image of that sky every either 60 seconds or 30 minutes, depending on which part of the image you're interested in. And it just does that again and again and again.
Mm-hmm. Do we on Earth, and I know there are many, many scientists across the country involved in the Kepler mission.
Around the world, actually.
Around the world. Yeah. Have any way to, are there jets? Can you make it turn in certain directions or?
It could, but we don't like to do that. The goal is, again, to concentrate on this same field of view forever or as long as the spacecraft lasts. So it does have thrusters which allow us to fine-tune the pointing. And every 3 months, you have to turn the telescope because it's powered by solar power. And as it goes around the sun, the solar cells start to point away from the sun. So we've got to turn it once every 3 months. But we turn it exactly 90 degrees, so we're still looking at exactly the same field of view.
Mm-hmm. What's its life expectancy?
The original mission was 3.5 years. In November of last year, we got an extension for another year, actually another several years, but with review every year. The eventual goal is to get 7 years of data with it in what we call the extended mission. But the primary mission is over. So we are on borrowed time.
Really? And based on other probes and craft that have been sent out, they often far exceed their life expectancy, don't they?
They are overbuilt a bit.
So when we talk about the mission for having so much for astronomers, even though it's just a simple camera looking out into space at one particular direction into our galaxy, the Milky Way, which is what part of our galaxy?
We're sitting in, as you said before, one of the arms of the Milky Way, and we're looking sort of along the arm but a little bit above it. So it's not looking outside of the galaxy, though there are some things in the Kepler field that are external galaxies to our own Milky Way.
What about this mission that has gone on for 4 years excites you most that we haven't mentioned yet?
Well, I mentioned the geek factor before about this amazing piece of technology and being a part of the results from that. But my main reason for getting involved with Kepler is I'm a stellar astronomer. I'm very interested in what stars are made of, what their interior structure is, how they change throughout their lives, and what will happen to them when they run out of fuel. And Kepler looks at stars. So it's the ideal telescope to measure the brightness of stars very precisely, not so much to look for planets, but it's also the ideal instrument to look for oscillations of stars, vibrations. And those vibrations, those star quakes, can tell us a lot of information about the stars inside as well as outside. So as a stellar seismologist or an astroseismologist, the Kepler mission has been very exciting to me and the community that I'm a part of because it's providing the best data we have ever seen on hundreds of thousands of stars to do our science.
Mm. So all of this hour up to this point, we've been talking about something that is off-center from your area of expertise, the planets.
They say, that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
We are arm-in-arm with the planetary people, though.
Okay. So tell me now, in the last 4 years, what has been most exciting that you, the discoveries we've made, the thinking that has evolved in terms of how we think about stars, how they form their lives, and how they eventually go.
So I was unaware that River to River is a two-hour show today.
Well, we've got a few minutes left here, another 15 minutes.
Ah, geez. The exciting discoveries of Kepler from stellar astronomy go everywhere from probing the insides of ordinary stars to precision measurements of the sizes of stars to measuring the physical conditions inside the star in terms of turbulence and stellar weather. To looking at stars that are like our sun will look in 5 billion years to see what the future fate of the sun is, what its structure will be, what will happen to the Earth's planetary systems. We've been measuring rotation rates of stars, mapping their surfaces in terms of star spots and the evolution of those star spots over time. We've probed rotation of the insides of the stars and seeing that some stars are rotating much more quickly inside than outside. It goes on and on and on. Mm-hmm. It's been a spectacular success from the astrophysics of stars standpoint.
Let me ask you it this way then. Are there things that Kepler has pointed out about stars and their lives that has been pointed out as a misunderstanding up to this point that has reshaped our understanding?
Yes. Let me go to the rotation of stars, for example. When the sun runs out of its hydrogen fuel in the center, it will grow into what we call a red giant star. Its radius will expand to almost the size of the Earth's orbit. That would be a terrible time to be alive 5 billion years from now. In the process, though, it'll slow in its rotation, right? Again, back to this ice skater when he or she pushes her arms out, his or her arms out, they slow down. And when the sun reaches this stage, it will spin more slowly. But we've never known what's going to go on the inside of the star. That is, will the core continue to rotate quickly, or will it slow down? And pretty much everybody that worked in the area, including me, said that, yes, the whole star will slow down. But we've been able now, using seismology, using starquakes, to measure the rotation rate of red giant stars on the outside and separately on the inside. And so that means when the sun grows to be a red giant, it's going to start getting all twisted up inside. The core will be rotating quickly and the outside will be rotating more slowly. And that has very interesting implications for the next stage in evolution, which is the loss of that envelope later on in the life of the star and what's left behind, whether the star that's left behind will be spinning quickly or slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we do see this so-called rapid core rotation in some red giant stars has been a total surprise, but very exciting.
Mm-hmm. And what difference does that make then for the eventual end of a star, of the end of our sun?
The energy of rotation, the energy of rotating of that central star plays an important role in clearing out the interstellar medium surrounding the star. That folds into the distribution of heavy elements that are produced by the nuclear furnace in the star and how that material is distributed through the galaxy. So when we look at the next sort of family of stars that form out of the what's left over of the previous family, the composition of those new stars will be affected by how much of the interstellar medium is the insides of the old stars. So if you run the movie forward of our sun eventually will push its material out into the interstellar medium. New stars will form, and the range of elements and the abundances of those elements will depend on how exactly the sun blew that material away.
Wow. This is Steve Kowaler is with us, an Iowa State University professor of physics and astronomy. He's been working with NASA's Kepler mission, to look for Earth-like planets in our part of the Milky Way. And in the last few minutes that we have here, Steve, I wanted to have you talk a little bit more about the involvement of Iowa State University here. You are, as you said, a stellar astronomer, specifically interested in the stars that Kepler is looking at. Give us an idea of how many scientists across the country and the world are involved in the Kepler mission.
The Kepler mission has the planet side and the star side. On the planet side, it's a fairly large group of astronomers. I measure it in the hundreds, worldwide, concentrated, though, in the United States. On the star side, the astroseismology is the principal astrophysics that we're doing, the starquake measurements. That's a group called the Kepler Astroseismic Science Consortium. I'm on the sort of the steering committee for that collaboration. There are now 600 members of that collaboration from many, many countries throughout the world. Within that bigger collaboration of astroseismologists, that's broken down into smaller groups depending on what kind of stars people are interested in studying. So if you add up all of the people that are connected with direct work on Kepler data, it's probably close to 1,000.
Mm. And this mission, if I understand it, it's an unmanned mission, of course. Well,
I volunteered, but they didn't want me.
It is. I mentioned that because it is. It makes it much cheaper to put out there. And there's always this debate about should we be putting our limited amount of money, especially in these economic times, towards manned or unmanned missions. And it seems like this unmanned mission has unearthed so much information with a relatively inexpensive instrument, isn't it?
That's right. This is a class of mission that's budgeted for about $600 million end-to-end cost. That may sound like a lot of money, and frankly, it is a lot of money. But if you look at the fact that Kepler has found so far, we think, at least 2,000 planetary systems, most awaiting confirmation, that's $2 a head for the telescope. And if you divide by the number of planets found, that's pennies per discovery per American. So that's not bad.
That is not bad. We've been saying Kepler, 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 Kepler the whole time this hour, but we haven't talked about Johannes Kepler. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about this German mathematician, astronomer. Mm-hmm. He lived some 400 years ago, and why he would be the namesake for this mission.
Well, Kepler was the first scientist to discover, and it truly is a discovery, the laws of planetary motion. He lived in a time when the Copernican system was still trying to be accepted in the time of Galileo and Tycho Brahe. And he looked at data actual data that were taken by Tycho Brahe, a Danish astronomer, who accurately measured the positions of the planets with respect to the stars. Kepler ran away from the idea that the planets were all moving in circles around the Earth and just looked at the data. He said, "Where did the data? What did the data tell us about how the planets are moving?" And he was able to figure out correctly that they move around the sun, first of all, that they move in ellipses, not circles, so sort of squash circles. And he found two other laws that are very important in terms of the speed of planets compared to how far they are away from the star and the orbital period of the planets. So his laws of planetary motion, which we still teach in the introductory astronomy courses today, set the stage for Newton's discovery of gravity and how gravity works.
Mm-hmm. Could Kepler, Johannes Kepler, have imagined the things that the Kepler mission is discovering today?
I think so. Kepler was a brilliant, had brilliant insight. He had several wrong ideas in terms of why these laws were around. A huge imagination, though. The idea that the Earth is the only planet, or rather the only planet that can harbor life, and that the solar system is the only solar system, was dying a death with the Copernican system being adopted. Because when people realized that planets were going around the sun, no one said, well, we're the only planetary system. It was common knowledge, if you will, in the 18th century into the 19th century that all stars had to have planets because all stars were like our sun. In the introductory astronomy textbooks of the 18th century and 19th century, they all talk about life on other worlds and the fact that our planet is probably not the only place for life, even in our solar system. The skepticism about life in the universe grew as we learned the scale of the universe. So scientists were sort of at fault here in killing the idea that life was everywhere in the late 19th century and into the early 20th century. Then we began to realize, yes, stars are like the sun. And yes, we might, as of the mid-last century, might be able to find planets around those stars. Mm-hmm. So the idea of the universe teeming with life has had its ups and downs as well.
So in the last 4 years of the Kepler mission in its search for Earth-like planets in our part of the Milky Way, do we have a new light on that question about life existing outside of our solar system?
Well, we have the first step, and the first step was to demonstrate whether or not Earth-like planets, and that is Earth-sized planets at the right distance from their star, are common or not. And we're getting close to determining that now. So, yes, we're getting closer to finding E.T.'s home, as Bill Borucki would say. Bill Borucki was is the father of the Kepler spacecraft. He conceived the mission and spent 20 years trying to get it to fly. And he's very fond of saying that Kepler was not designed to find E.T., but it was designed to find E.T.'s home. And we may be close to that.
Mm-hmm. But even if we, through these observations, find out that there probably is some life out there, it doesn't mean that we could ever have contact with it, does it?
As you mentioned before, yeah, these so-called closed systems are hundreds of light years away. And while Kepler won't find life, the follow-up observations from the ground might be able to find the signature of life by finding, for example, oxygen in the atmospheres of some of these worlds. Follow-up observations by the James Webb Space Telescope, for example, are being planned for that sort of thing. But even if we find evidence of oxygen in the atmosphere, that's evidence of plant life, not intelligent organisms. Communicating with them in a two-way fashion won't happen, but at least one way might.
With your knowledge, are you convinced there's life out there somewhere?
I'm more optimistic. I mean, until it's proven, until we find this uncontrovertible evidence for biological activity, or until we get a broadcast or something lands on the ellipse in Washington, I won't be 100% convinced, but I'm fairly confident and comforted that the probability is getting higher and higher.
I guess we have time for this question, and I'd love to ask this question of scientists, and I hope you love this question, too. We're going to make believe I'm an all-knowing genie here at the end. And Steve Kowalar, I get to be the person, the genie who answers one question about your field of astronomy. What would be a question that you would love to ask an all-knowing genie about your field?
That's an excellent question. I had not thought about that. But my question would be sort of gearing towards the future. Is there some accessible technology for traveling faster than the speed of light? I'm waiting for the answer now.
Okay. We've run out of time, Steve. I won't be able to hold up my end of the bargain as the genie if I were to be one. Steve Gowaller, we'll leave that question. That's a great ending to our conversation. Very fascinating. Iowa State University professor of physics and astronomy, Steve Gowaller, affiliated with NASA's Kepler mission. And we'd love to check in with you again, Steve, for another fascinating update of what's going on way out there. Steve, thank you.
Well, thank you.
And that brings us to a close of River to River for today. More like a planet to planet, I guess. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. In Ames, we had help from Jason Burns. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Technical support from Dennis Reese. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.